Our second case for this morning is National Labor Relations Board against Irving Ready Mix, Incorporated, appeal number 111371. Good morning, Mr. Hall.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Scott Hall. May it please the Court. I'm here on behalf of Irving Ready Mix, which is the appellant in this case. This is an appeal of an injunction issued under Section 10J of the National Labor Relations Act by the District Court in the Northern District of Indiana. This appeal centers on the appropriate means by which the building and construction industry status of employers and employees are to be determined as to whether they're covered under Section 8F of the National Labor Relations Act. Irving is a ready-mix concrete company headquartered in Fort Wayne, Indiana. It employs truck drivers of its ready-mix trucks, the large trucks with barrels on the top that spin, holding up to 11 cubic yards of ready-mix concrete.
So I have a question for you right off the bat, since this is, as you pointed out, a 10J injunction. I understand that your client disagrees with the line of cases that the board began with the J.P. Sturris decision, but it's unclear to me that this is the right moment for this court to consider that. We're just looking at the question whether the district court abused its discretion in issuing the injunction, and the injunction itself was premised on the fact that there is this line of cases in the board, and it seemed that there was enough of a likelihood of success on the merits to go forward. If this injunction stays in place, there's nothing that would prevent Irving from trying to persuade the board not to follow Sturris anymore, or eventually in an appeal to this court telling us that Sturris is wrong. So isn't this the wrong procedural posture?
With all due respect, Your Honor, we consider this to be a legal issue as to the appropriate standard to apply in making the determination. The board, in its petition for the injunction, asked the district court to find that the union with whom Irving had the contract was a Section 9 representative, and the board relied on the J.P. Sturris decision as the basis.
And thereafter, as you'll concede, there are quite a few other decisions that have followed Sturris.
Well, there are other decisions, Your Honor, that reference Sturris and Sturris' holding concerning the Section 8F status of a ready-mix concrete company. What we're asking is to go back to the basis of Sturris and to show why it was an aberration.
But, you know, I mean, if we're going to do that, and I'm just going to reserve my concern about the procedural posture, this court, in a slightly different context, this was the decision about people setting cones down, commented on the fact that these ready-mix drivers are in what I'll call a gray area. They're not people like the hardware store who supplies nuts and bolts to the construction site. And they're not people like a carpenter who's standing there on the construction site building something. They're somewhere in between. And the line that was used was the trackless wilderness. But it seems that this is something that calls for a line drawing, which is exactly what the board does. And this court defers to the court's, to the board's decision about where to put somebody who is somewhere in the middle. I mean, your drivers have worked for 15, 20 years at Irving. They visit different sites. They, you know, we've all driven past. We know exactly how these things work. There's some assistance to construction, but in some ways they're not. I mean, why isn't this exactly what we have a National Labor Relations Board for?
Your Honor, if I may, the line was drawn on the ready-mix concrete industry contrary to the way the board had drawn the lines pre-Sturris and post-Sturris.
So what? I mean, if the board thinks that this is the best place to draw the line, administrative agencies revisit questions like this all the time. There's no hint that I can see that the board itself wants to revisit Sturris.
Your Honor, this court in 1993 in the Raleigh-Shunjin case, which is cited in our brief, encountered a near mirror image to this case. In that particular case, the issue was a district court decision based upon...
Maybe you're answering my question, but it doesn't feel like it to me. I mean, I don't see what glimpse there is that this is anything but something that could be characterized on either side of the 9A line and something that sensibly can be characterized as not being in the construction industry for this 8F purpose. And so I don't see why the board isn't justified in making the call.
Your Honor, as I stated, this court has held that when the board, who does get deference as the administrative agency put in charge of these matters under the National Labor Relations Act, has a decision where they have not distinguished the reasoning for that that decision from prior cases, which is in Raleigh-Shunjin, when a case under Section 8E of the Act involved a decision that was done under Section 8F of the Act, which is a totally different portion of the Act, and the district court reliance on that aberrational decision was considered to be and the district court's decision was reversed.
Well, I know we did that in that case, but it appears to me that here the board itself has decided that there's no sense in reading these terms in a dramatically different way between Section 8E and Section 8F. It seems to me a rational person could do this, and like what you want us is to grade the board on how much it wrote in Sturrus?
Your Honor, what I want is to look at the Sturrus decision, which specifically misquoted and misstated prior board precedent, when it said that the Inland Concrete decision and the Island Dock Lumber decisions made a finding on an employer's Section 8F status, when neither of those cases did anything of that sort. In fact,
talking about what the administrative law judge said, and he says 8E and 8F. I don't know that it's a misquote so much as just extending further. Maybe it's a little bit of an overstatement, but the main point is the board in that case endorses the ALJ's decision, doesn't change that, holds in its capacity that this is the way it wants it to be, and continues with that holding.
That is true, Your Honor. But the thing is,
why isn't that it then? I mean, why doesn't that at least justify a 10J injunction?
The things that the board cited in its additional wording placed on the Sturrus decision had nothing to do with the work that the actual work that the ready-mix truck drivers do as part of their duties.
Why isn't there a seven-day provision in the truck driver, the seven-day pre-hire rule instead of a 30-day pre-hire rule?
It's not required, Your Honor.
Yeah, but it's one of the indicia that shows whether 8F is a sensible model or 9A.
Even the board in the Techno Construction case decided in 2001, which has been cited in the briefs in this case, the ALJ held that that doesn't indicate whether anything, because it's a possibility that you can have a shorter union security clause, but the law doesn't require it. It's a matter of bargaining.
But the point is that the purpose of 8F has to do with the nature of construction sites, the episodic natures. Maybe you have a form layer there. Maybe you've got somebody, you know, the plumbing people are there, and then they go, whereas your company is providing material that's used for the construction. These guys are the drivers of the trucks.
These guys are the drivers of the trucks, and they install the ready-mix concrete on the job sites.
Well, they pour it.
I'd like to address that issue if I could, in particular some of the numbers that you've put into your brief, because you seem to be saying that, in essence, that you ought to be able to treat every dollar paid for a concrete delivery as construction labor dollars, right?
On the basis of the board's decision, which has been the gold standard since 1966 in Indio Paint.
Yeah, well,
The difference between labor and material costs is immaterial. It is a gross income percentage basis related to the construction process.
Okay, here's my concern. We've got total revenues here, total sales, let's say, for 2007 on the order of $9.5 million. Okay, and roughly eight and a half are sort of so-called primary product, ready-mix concrete sales, right? Your wage costs for that would be what, on the order of $1 million, $1.25 million?
I don't know the
answer. How much do these guys make? That's what everybody's fighting about.
I think at the time on the expired contract, it was approximately $20 an hour.
Okay, and gross costs, gross labor costs for the company, let's say they're below $1.5 million, okay? I'll just be explicit about what I'm driving at here. As Judge Wood suggested, this is kind of in a gray area because the product that you're selling winds up bundling together the material and the transportation charges and the labor, right?
Yes, sir.
Because as a practical matter, I assume your company doesn't sell ready-mix concrete to customers who bring their own trucks.
They only through their own trucks. They do not load the vehicles of others.
And I assume that you also don't sell unbundled material and transportation, unbundled from labor, the labor on the work site.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean, Your Honor. They do sell concrete-related products, such
right.
as rebar and wire
sure.
mesh and expansion joint materials.
Now, my point is that the ready-mix concrete, just because of the nature of the material, winds up being sold in this bundle that includes transportation, installation labor, and the material itself, right?
Yes, sir. It's a yard per yard cost.
Right. And the labor component of that is a relatively modest component.
I don't know the actual breakout of that, Your Honor.
You and the union have been fighting over what those labor costs are bitterly over the last several years. Are you telling me you have no idea what?
Your Honor, you're asking for a component of total labor costs. Then you would need to add in the total yardage and try to figure out those costs and the yards sold related to those costs. The reason why, I guess I'm a little ignorant of it, Your Honor, is because the board in the Indio Paint case made no distinction between what part of it was labor and what part of it was materials. It says it is a percentage of gross revenues related to the construction process.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it really, according to board standard since 1966, the division of labor versus materials is inconsequential.
Well, let's suppose I take a different view of that, and let's talk about that, okay? Because the concern that I have here is that given the wage levels we're talking about, labor is a relatively modest component. I'm eyeballing it. If you don't know the answer, just take my estimate of that, okay? Labor is a relatively modest portion of the overall charges that your company collects. I believe the figures here in our record indicate that something like 30 to 35% of the driver's time is spent on construction sites.
Yes, sir.
And you're contending about 70% of that time is spent on construction labor, installing the product. Is that right?
It's our position that the entire 30 to 35% is construction labor.
Well, okay, but in terms of time, it's because the concrete sets up so quickly that they have to wash off materials and equipment on the site, right?
Yes, Your Honor. The same
okay.
as the painter has to wash his brushes.
Sure. But we're not talking about painters here. We're not talking about carpenters. We're talking about a product where the vast bulk of the expense is associated with the material itself and the transportation services, the delivery that is provided, neither of which can qualify as construction labor. So I guess I'm trying to raise with you some concerns. This may be in a gray area, but I'm trying to suggest it's a lot closer to the hardware store than it is to the carpenter.
Your Honor, with respect, Your Honor, again, the Indio Paint case on which we have relied in our brief extensively and which has been the benchmark since 1966 involved the retail sale of hard and soft floor coverings. The labor component, and if you look at the case, you'll notice that the labor component in that case is less than the material component, if I'm not mistaken. But in that case, the board determined that it really doesn't make a difference what part is labor and what part is materials if you're involved in the construction industry. In fact,
why does Indio Paint deserve more deference in this case than J.P. Sturrus?
Because, Your Honor, that was the standard set before Sturrus. It's been the standard followed since Sturrus. And what happened in Sturrus was, is for some reason, the board went away from the historic analysis that it would have used to determine an employer's Section 8F standing.
Okay. You are running short on time, so I'm just going to alert you that if you want to save, like, half a minute for rebuttal, this would be a good way to do it. Yes, Mr. Socolow.
May it please the Court. My name is Stephen L. Socolow. I represent Rick Limebeck, who was the regional director of the board's regional office in Indianapolis, who filed the petition for Section 10J relief in this case.
I have an odd procedural question for you, Mr. Socolow, which is whether in these cases the board tends to think of it as Lineback versus Irving Ready Mix or NLRB versus Irving Ready Mix.
The answer to the question is, it is Mr. Lineback for and on behalf of the National Labor Relations Board.
That's how you've got your brief. So it sounds to me like maybe we should style it Lineback versus.
That's the way it typically is. There are a few cases with NLRB, but if you look at the Lineback versus Sperlino case, for example, Kinney versus a number of companies, those are the names of the directors.
That's the way I did it.
But the company here withdrew recognition from the union that has been representing its employees for over 30 years. There is no dispute that the union never lost the support of the majority of those employees. The district court correctly notes that decades of board precedent support the director's position that Irving and its employees are not in the construction industry, and that therefore the director had a likelihood of success in proving that Section 9A governs the relationship as it does for all employers covered by the Act except for construction employers. And as Your Honor had pointed out earlier, that really is the point of this case. There is a line of cases covering employers exactly like Irving Ready Mix. Therefore, there is a likelihood of success in this case.
So what's your comment about Mr. Hall's heavy reliance on Indio Paint?
First, the district court and this court should not engage in an analysis of whether Irving Ready Mix and its employees fit the Indio Paint analysis. The Indio Paint does control. The company here is relying on one aspect of it, which is an analysis of revenues from the company's point of view. The company's status as being primarily in the building and construction industry is only one of three requirements under Section 8F. The company doesn't say much about the requirement that the employees be engaged in construction work as well.
So if a company were in the construction industry somehow and its administrative assistants at the home office wanted to organize and get a union, then I take it that would be an example of employees who are not construction workers, but they work for a company. Is that the line that you're drawing?
I believe that line would be drawn by the board. I'm not aware of any cases exactly like that. We do have some cases in the 8E area that involve employees who do some non-construction work. But, yes, the employees involved under Section 8F have to be construction workers, which is sort of the point of Section 8F. These employees would be off the job before a representation proceeding could develop because their employer's work on the project could be over. The building will be built in that. But our position is that the district court correctly did not base its decision on that analysis. The district court correctly based its decision on the fact that there is a line of cases, quite a long line of cases, holding that ready-mix delivery is not construction work and that the drivers are drivers, they are not construction workers.
So what if we thought, just hypothetically, that the board had really taken leave of its senses in this line of cases? Would that, and thus that when all was said and done, we were going to disapprove it if that day ever came. I mean, it may or may not. Of course, sometimes things are actually resolved. Would that be a reason at the 10J stage to say, you know, the board has just been zany in this area, and we don't think that this is the proper characterization, and thus there shouldn't be?
No, Your Honor. The statutory scheme provides for the board to get the first crack at deciding this kind of an issue.
Is that almost an exhaustion argument that Irving needs to present its criticisms of Sturrus first to the board in the ULP proceedings?
Well, I know that it's different in some ways from the exhaustion concept in other areas of the law, but it's something like that.
It's a cousin. I mean, I don't mean to say strictly speaking, but
it's a cousin, but the purpose is different because the board is set up under the Act to decide these issues in the first instance. It's a primary jurisdiction issue. The courts of appeals will have a chance to review the board's decision in this case if it goes that far. But at this stage, as this court has repeatedly said, the question is whether there is a likelihood of success with a relatively low threshold in terms of an evidentiary and legal showing.
It's a low threshold to become eligible for 10J relief, but isn't there room for a sliding scale under 10J where one looks at relative harms and evaluations about likelihood of success can be more subtle than simply just better than negligible?
That's correct in general, Your Honor. The sliding scale concept goes to how much of a burden the board has in showing irreparable harms and the balance of harms in these kinds of cases. Irving Ready Mix has not raised any of those issues in this appeal. The only issue here is likelihood of success.
I recognize that. I'm trying to follow up on your dialogue with Judge Wood.
But that's true. Mm-hmm. And the stronger that our case would be on the merits, the less we would need to show with respect to the harms. Here, I assert that we have a very strong showing on the merits. But the harms also speak for themselves, as the district court noted.
Is the board satisfied that the employer is complying with the injunction at this point?
Yes, Your Honor. I checked with our office quite recently, and we have received no complaints.
Compensation has been restored to under the old contract?
That's what the injunction calls for, and my understanding is that compensation has been restored. Other changes were restored before the litigation of the 10J case, and as far as I understand it, the injunction is being complied with. Well, I don't want to get too repetitive.
You're not required to use every minute if you don't want to.
I wanted to check and see if I missed anything. One is the Respondents' Council contends the Sturrus is contrary to pre- and post-Sturrus decisions, and we don't believe that's true. On the one hand, there had not been a case decided under Section 8F involving ready-mix delivery drivers before Sturrus, but there had been Section 8E cases in that area, and they say as clearly as they can say that the delivery of ready-mix is not construction work. In addition, there have been cases involving the delivery of many other kinds of materials to construction sites before and since Sturrus.
I take it these determinations of, you know, is it a 9A or an 8F, are really quite industry and product specific for the board.
Not when it comes to deliveries. I think we'll see a real line drawn, as this court mentioned in United Rentals, that if there's a truck going to a site and then leaving the site when they're done delivering, that's not construction.
Okay, so there's some broad guidance. I was just thinking that that there are many variations I can imagine in the way different products may wind up there and in the work assigned to the driver of the truck. If the driver hops out and, you know, and installs the linoleum or what have you, maybe the driver's doing more.
Yes, And, the way these cases have come up, it seems, for reasons that I don't understand, that they seem to come up in the ADE area more, where it's the surveyor who's also the office manager or the person setting out the cones and setting up the concrete barriers before the construction work begins. But in the 8F area, when it comes to delivering anything to the site, the board has been very consistent since 1963. Unless there are any other questions.
Apparently not, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Your
Honor. You have about, I'll give you a full minute, Mr. Hall.
Thank you, Your Honor, very briefly. A couple of things I heard. The length of coverage of the prior agreements, I think, you know, Irving had contracts with this union for a number of years. Is specifically of no significance because John Dekla and Sons, which is the primary board case in determining the rights of the parties under Section 8F agreements, had collective bargaining agreements spanning 25 years, and there was no problem with their agreement being considered an 8F agreement. There was never any showing of support under the Irving contract. Irving's contract doesn't say anything about majority support on the part of the union. It's typical 8F language. Your Honor, in response to your cost of materials questions, I did check with the Indio Paint, and the cost of materials was over twice the labor costs in that case. But again, the issue is immaterial in terms of whether the costs are related to labor or materials under the Indio Paint analysis. Reference was made to the Irving ready mix drivers. What we've been banging on all along is that if you look at the amount of time, they are not like sand drivers or gravel drivers or hardware drivers who simply come to the site. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
All right. No, point taken. And we appreciate both of your presentations. The court will take the case under advisement.